Whereas the infertility and salinity of Australia's soils are not well known outside of Australia among the lay public today, Australia's water problems are obvious and familiar, such that desert is the first association of most people overseas to mention of the Australian environment. That reputation is justified. Much of Australia's area remains useless today for any form of agriculture or pastoralism. In those areas where food production is possible, the usual pattern is that rainfall is higher near the coast than inland, so that as one proceeds inland, one first encounters farmland for growing crops, plus half of Australia's cattle maintained at high stocking rates. Further inland, sheep stations. Still further inland, cattle stations, the other half of Australia's cattle maintained at very low stocking rates. And finally, still further inland, the desert. A more subtle problem about Australia's rainfall than its low average values is its unpredictability. In many parts of the world supporting agriculture, the season in which rain falls is predictable from year to year. Major droughts are infrequent, and a farmer can go to the effort and expense of plowing and planting each year with the expectation that there will be enough rain for that crop to mature. Over most of Australia, however, rainfall depends upon the so-called ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which means that rain is unpredictable from year to year within a decade, and is even more unpredictable from decade to decade. In many areas of Australia, the first farmers and herders had the misfortune to arrive during a string of wet years. Hence, they were deceived into misjudging the Australian climate, and they commenced raising crops or sheep in the expectation that the favorable conditions greeting their eyes were the norm. In fact, in most of Australia's farmlands, the rainfall is sufficient to raise crops to maturity in only a fraction of all years. That contributes to making Australian agriculture expensive and uneconomic. The farmer goes to the expense of plowing and sowing, and then in half or more of years, there is no resulting crop. An additional unfortunate consequence is that when the farmer plows under whatever cover of weeds has sprung up since the last harvest, bare soil becomes exposed. If the crops that the farmer then sows do not mature, the soil is left bare and thus exposed to erosion. The principal exception to Australia's ENSO-driven pattern of unpredictable rain is the wheat belt of its southwest, where, at least until recently, the winter rains came reliably, and a farmer could count on a successful wheat crop almost every year. That reliability propelled wheat within recent decades to overtake wool and meat as Australia's most valuable agricultural export. But global climate change has been undermining the predictable winter rains. They have declined dramatically since 1973, while increasingly frequent summer rains there fall on harvested bare ground and cause increased salinization. Australian historians speak of the tyranny of distance as an important factor in Australia's development. That expression refers to the long overseas ship journeys, making transport costs for Australian exports higher than for exports from the New World to Europe, so that only products with low bulk and high value could be exported economically from Australia. Originally, in the 19th century, minerals and wool were the main such exports. Today, Australia's principal exports remain low-bulk, high-value items, including steel, minerals, wool, and wheat. Increasingly, within the last few decades, wine and macadamia nuts as well, and also some specialty crops aimed at niche markets for which some consumers are willing to pay a premium, such as durum wheat and other special wheat varieties, and wheat and beef raised without pesticides or other chemicals. But there is an additional tyranny of distance, one within Australia itself. Australia's productive or settled areas are few and scattered. The country has a population only 1/14 that of the U.S., scattered over an area equal to that of the U.S.'s lower 48 states. The resulting high costs of transportation within Australia make it expensive to sustain a first-world civilization there. For example, the Australian government pays for telephone connection to the national phone grid for any Australian home or business at any location within Australia, even for outback stations hundreds of miles from the nearest station. Today, Australia is the most urbanized country in the world, with 58% of its population concentrated in just five large cities. Among those five, Perth is the world's most isolated large city, lying further than any other from the next large city, Adelaide, 1,300 miles to the east. It is no accident that two of Australia's largest companies, its national airline Qantas and its telecommunications company Telstra, are based on bridging those distances. Australia's internal tyranny of distance, in combination with its droughts, is also responsible for the fact that banks and other businesses are closing their branches in Australia's isolated towns, because those branches have become uneconomic. Doctors are leaving those towns for the same reason. As a result, Australia is increasingly without medium-sized towns. Instead, most Australians today either live in a few large cities with all the amenities of the modern first world, or in smaller villages, or else outback stations without banks, doctors, or other amenities. Australia's small villages of a few hundred people can survive a five-year drought, such as arises often in Australia's unpredictable climate, because the village has so little economic activity anyway. Big cities can also survive a five-year drought because they integrate the economy over a huge catchment area. But a five-year drought tends to wipe out medium-sized towns, whose existence depends on their ability to provide enough business branches and services to compete with more distant cities, but which aren't big enough to integrate over a huge catchment. Increasingly, most Australians don't depend on or really live in the Australian environment. They live instead in those five big cities, which are connected to the outside world rather than to the Australian landscape. Europe claimed most of its overseas colonies in hopes of financial gain or supposed strategic advantages. The unique exception was Australia, whose immigrants for many decades arrived not to seek their fortunes, but because they were compelled to go there. Britain's principal motive for settling Australia was to relieve its festering problem of large numbers of jailed poor people, and to forestall a rebellion that might otherwise break out if they could not somehow be disposed of. Initially, the two leading locations under consideration were either 400 miles up the Gambia River in tropical West Africa, or else in desert between modern South Africa and Namibia. It was the impossibility of both of those proposals that led to the fallback choice of Australia's Botany Bay, near the site of modern Sydney, known at the time only from Captain Cook's visit in 1770. That was how the first fleet brought to Australia in 1788 its first European settlers, consisting of convicts plus soldiers to guard them. Convict shipments went on until 1868, and through the 1840s they comprised most of Australia's European settlers. With time, four other scattered Australian coastal sites besides Sydney, near the sites of the modern cities of Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, and Hobart, were chosen as locations of other convict dumps. Those settlements became the nucleus of five colonies, governed separately by Britain, that eventually became five of the six states of modern Australia: New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, Western Australia, and Tasmania, respectively. All five of those initial settlements were at locations chosen for their harbors or locations on rivers, rather than for any agricultural advantages. That was not the case, however, for the area around Adelaide that became the nucleus of the remaining modern Australian state, South Australia. There, good soil resulting from geological uplift, plus fairly reliable winter rains, attracted German farmers as the sole early group of emigrants not from Britain. When European settlement of Australia began in 1788, Australia had, of course, been settled for over 40,000 years by Aborigines, who had worked out successful, sustainable solutions to the continent's daunting environmental problems. At the sites of initial European occupation, and in subsequently settled areas suitable for farming, Australian whites had even less use for Aborigines than white Americans had for Indians. The Indians in the eastern United States were at least farmers and provided crops critical for survival of European settlers during the first years. Aboriginal Australians, however, did not farm, hence could not provide food, and were killed or driven out of the initial white-settled areas. Just as the Norse settlers of Greenland brought over the cultural values of their Norwegian homeland, so too did the British settlers of Australia carry British cultural values. Some of those imported cultural values proved inappropriate to the Australian environment, and some of those inappropriate values continue to have legacies today. Five sets of cultural values were particularly important: those involving sheep, rabbits and foxes, native Australian vegetation, land values, and British identity. In the 18th century, Britain produced little wool itself, but instead imported it from Spain and Saxony. Those sources of wool were cut off during the Napoleonic Wars, raging during the first decades of British settlement in Australia. Britain's King George III was particularly interested in this problem, and with his support, the British succeeded in smuggling merino sheep from Spain into Britain, and then sending some to Australia to become the founders of Australia's wool flock. Australia evolved into Britain's main source of wool. Today, a significant fraction of all food-producing land in Australia is still used for sheep. Sheep farming is ingrained into Australia's cultural identity, and rural voters, whose livelihood depends on sheep, are disproportionately influential in Australian politics. But the appropriateness of Australian land for sheep is deceptive. While it initially supported lush grass, its soil productivity was very low, so the sheep farmers were, in effect, mining the land's fertility. Australia's existing sheep industry is a money-losing proposition, and its legacy is ruinous land degradation through overgrazing. Whereas introduced sheep have undoubtedly been of great economic benefit as well as harm to Australia, introduced rabbits and foxes have been unmitigated disasters. British colonists found Australia's environment alien and wanted to be surrounded by familiar European plants and animals. Hence, they attempted to introduce many European bird species, only two of which, the house sparrow and starling, became widespread. At least those introduced bird species have not done much harm, while Australia's rabbits and plague numbers cause enormous economic damage and land degradation by consuming about half of the pasture vegetation that would otherwise have been available to sheep and cattle. The combination of introduced rabbits and introduced foxes has been a major cause of the extinctions or population crashes of most species of small native Australian mammals. Foxes prey on them, and rabbits compete with native herbivorous mammals for food. European rabbits and foxes were introduced to Australia almost simultaneously. It is unclear whether foxes were introduced first to permit traditional British fox hunting, then rabbits introduced later to provide additional food for the foxes, or whether rabbits were introduced first for hunting or to make the countryside look more like Britain, and then foxes introduced later to control the rabbits. In any case, both have been such expensive disasters that it now seems incredible that they were introduced for such trivial reasons. Even more incredible are the efforts to which Australians went to establish rabbits. The first four attempts failed, and not until wild Spanish rabbits were used for the fifth attempt did success follow. Ever since those rabbits and foxes did become established and Australians realized the consequences, they have been trying to eliminate or reduce their populations. The war against foxes involves poisoning or trapping them. One method in the war against rabbits, memorable to all non-Australians who saw the recent film Rabbit Proof Fence, is to divide up the landscape by long fences and attempt to eliminate rabbits from one side of the fence. Farmer Bill McIntosh told me how he makes a map of his property to mark the locations of every one of its thousands of rabbit burrows, which he destroys individually with a bulldozer. He then returns to a burrow later, and if it shows any first sign of rabbit activity, he drops dynamite down the burrow. In this laborious way, he has destroyed 3,000 rabbit burrows. Such expensive measures led Australians several decades ago to place great hopes in introducing a rabbit disease called myxomatosis, which initially did reduce the population by over 90%, until rabbits became resistant and rebounded. Current efforts to control rabbits are using another microbe called the callici virus. Just as British colonists felt uncomfortable amidst Australia's strange-looking kangaroos and friar birds, they also felt uncomfortable among Australia's eucalyptus and acacia trees. Settlers cleared the land of vegetation partly because they didn't like its appearance, but also for agriculture. Until about 20 years ago, the Australian government not only subsidized land clearance but actually required it of leaseholders. Much agricultural land in Australia is not owned outright by farmers, but is owned by the government and leased to farmers. The ecological economist Mike Young, whose job for the Australian government now includes the task of figuring out how much land has been rendered worthless by land clearance, told me of his childhood memories of clearing land with his father on their family farm. Mike and his father would each drive a tractor, the two tractors advancing in parallel and connected by a chain, with the chain dragging over the ground to remove native vegetation and replace it with crops, in return for which his father received a big tax deduction. Without that deduction provided by the government as an incentive, much of the land would never have been cleared. As settlers arrived in Australia and began buying or leasing land from each other or from the government, land prices were set according to values prevailing back home in England, and justified there by the returns that could be obtained from England's productive soils. In Australia, that has meant that land is overcapitalized. That is, it sells or leases for more than can be justified by the financial returns from agricultural use of the land. When a farmer then buys or leases land and takes out a mortgage, the need to pay the interest on that high mortgage pressures the farmer to try to extract more profit from the land than it could sustainably yield. Land overcapitalization resulting from British cultural values has been a major contributor to the Australian practice of overstocking, which has led to overgrazing, soil erosion, and farmer bankruptcies and abandonments. More generally, high valuation on land has translated into Australians embracing rural agricultural values justified by their British background, but not justified by Australia's low agricultural productivity. Those rural values continue to pose an obstacle to solving one of modern Australia's built-in political problems. The Australian Constitution gives a disproportionate vote to rural areas. This strong rural vote ignores the already mentioned reality that Australia is the most highly urbanized nation. They have contributed to the government's long-continued perverse support for measures mining rather than sustaining the environment, such as land clearance and indirect subsidies of uneconomic rural areas. Until 50 years ago, emigration to Australia was overwhelmingly from Britain and Ireland. Those emotional ties to Britain continue today. Britain still appoints a Governor-General for Australia with the power to fire the Australian Prime Minister, and he actually did so in 1975. Until the early 1970s, Australia maintained a White Australia policy and virtually banned immigration from its Asian neighbors, a policy that understandably angered them. Only within the last 25 years has Australia belatedly become engaged with its Asian neighbors, accepted Asian immigrants, and cultivated Asian trade partners. Until 1950, agricultural products, especially wool, were Australia's main exports, followed by minerals. Today, Australia is still the world's largest wool producer, but Australian production and overseas demand are both decreasing because of increasing competition from synthetic fibers. Australia's number of sheep peaked in 1970 at 180 million and has been declining steadily ever since. Almost all of Australia's wool production is exported, especially to China and Hong Kong. Other important agricultural exports include wheat, specialty durum wheat, wine, and chemical-free beef. At present, Australia produces more food than it consumes and is a net food exporter. But Australia's domestic food consumption is increasing as its population grows. If that trend continues, Australia could become a net importer rather than exporter of food. Wool and other agricultural products now rank only in third place among Australia's earners of foreign exchange, behind tourism, number two, and minerals, number one. Australia is the world's leading exporter of coal. It has the world's largest reserves of uranium, lead, silver, zinc, titanium, and tantalum, and is among the world's top six countries in its reserves of coal, iron, aluminum, copper, nickel, and diamonds. Especially its reserves of coal and iron are huge and not expected to run out in the foreseeable future. While Australia's largest export customers for its minerals used to be Britain and other European countries, Asian countries now import nearly five times more minerals from Australia than do European countries. Japan buys nearly half of Australia's exported coal, iron, and aluminum. In short, over the last half century, Australia's exports have shifted from predominantly agricultural products to minerals, while its trade partners have shifted from Europe to Asia. The U.S. remains Australia's largest source of imports and, after Japan, its second largest export customer. Those shifts in trade patterns have been accompanied by shifts in immigration. With an area similar to that of the U.S., Australia has a much smaller population, currently about 20 million, for the obvious good reason that the Australian environment is far less productive and can support far fewer people. Nevertheless, in the 1950s, many Australians, including government leaders, looked fearfully at Australia's much more populous Asian neighbors, especially Indonesia with its 200 million people. Many Australians concluded that their country suffered from a dangerous problem of being greatly underpopulated compared to those Asian neighbors, and that it would become a tempting target for Indonesian expansion unless it quickly filled all that empty space. Hence, the 1950s and 1960s brought a crash program to attract immigrants as a matter of public policy. That program involved abandoning the country's former white Australia policy, under which immigration was not only virtually restricted to people of European origin, but even predominantly to people from Britain and Ireland. The perceived population shortage led the government first to accept and then actively to recruit immigrants from other European countries. Not until the 1970s did the desire to attract more immigrants, combined with growing recognition of Australia's Pacific rather than just British identity, induce the government to remove legal obstacles to Asian immigration. While Britain, Ireland, and New Zealand are still Australia's major sources of immigrants, one quarter of all immigrants now come from Asian countries. Immigration reached its all-time peak in the late 1980s, with the result that nearly one-quarter of all Australians today are immigrants born overseas. The fallacy behind this policy of filling up Australia is that there are compelling environmental reasons why, even after more than two centuries of European settlement, Australia has not filled itself up to the population density of the U.S. Given Australia's limited supplies of water and limited potential for food production, it lacks the capacity to support a significantly larger population. Nevertheless, many influential Australians, including the recent Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, the leaders of both major political parties and the Australian Business Council, still argue that Australia should try to increase its population to 50 million people. The reasoning invokes a combination of continued fear of the yellow peril from overpopulated Asian countries, the aspiration for Australia to become a major world power, and the belief that that goal could not be achieved if Australia had only 20 million people. But Australians today no longer expect to become a major world power. Even if they did have that expectation, Israel, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Singapore provide examples of countries with populations far less than that of Australia that nevertheless are major economic powers and make big contributions to world technological innovation and culture. Contrary to their government and business leaders, 70% of Australians say that they want less rather than more immigration. In the long run, it is doubtful that Australia can even support its present population. The best estimate of a population sustainable at the present standard of living is 8 million people, less than half of the present population. Driving inland from the state capital of Adelaide in South Australia, I saw in this prime farmland of Australia one ruin after another of abandoned farms. Much of that area was developed for sheep farming during the wet years of the 1850s and early 1860s, when the land was covered with grass and looked lush. With droughts beginning in 1864, the overgrazed landscape became littered with the bodies of dead sheep, and those sheep farms were abandoned. A series of wet years in the 1870s encouraged the government to resell at high prices the abandoned sheep farms as small, overcapitalized wheat farms. Those wheat farms succeeded for a few years of abnormally high rainfall until they too failed and became consolidated into larger holdings that reverted to being large sheep farms in the late 1870s. With the return of drought, many of those sheep farms subsequently failed once again, and those that still survive today cannot support themselves based on sheep. Their farmer owners require second jobs, tourism, or outside investments to make a living. There have been more or less similar histories in most other food-producing areas of Australia. What made so many initially profitable food-producing properties become less profitable? The reason is Australia's number one environmental problem, land degradation, resulting from a set of nine types of damaging environmental impacts: clearance of native vegetation, overgrazing by sheep, rabbits, soil nutrient exhaustion, soil erosion, man-made droughts, weeds, misguided government policies, and salinization. Briefly, these impacts are as follows. Australia still clears more native vegetation per year than any other first world country, and its clearance rates are exceeded in the world only by Brazil, Indonesia, the Congo, and Bolivia. Most of Australia's current land clearance is going on in the state of Queensland for the purpose of creating pasture land for beef cattle. The Queensland government has announced that it will phase out large-scale clearing, but not until 2006. The resulting damage to Australia includes land degradation through dry land salinization and soil erosion, impairment of water quality by runoff of salt and sediment, loss of agricultural productivity and land values, and damage to the Great Barrier Reef. Rotting and burning of the bulldozed vegetation contribute to Australia's annual greenhouse gas emissions, a gas quantity approximately equal to the country's total motor vehicle emissions. A second major cause of land degradation is overstocking of sheep in numbers that graze down the vegetation faster than it can regrow. In some areas, overgrazing was ruinous and irreversible because it led to loss of the soil. Today, now that overgrazing's effects are recognized, the Australian government imposes maximum stocking rates for sheep. Formerly, however, the government imposed minimum stocking rates. Farmers were obliged to stock a certain minimum number of sheep per acre as a condition of holding the lease. Just as true for land clearance, the government canceled leases of farmers who failed to damage the land. Three other causes of land degradation have already been mentioned. Rabbits remove vegetation, cost farmers by reducing the pasturage available to sheep and cattle, and also cost farmers through the expense of the measures that farms adopt to control rabbit populations. Nutrient exhaustion of soils often develops within the first few years of agriculture because of the low initial nutrient content of Australian soils. Erosion of topsoil by water and wind increases after its cover of vegetation has been thinned or cleared. The resulting runoff of soil via rivers into the sea, by making coastal waters turbid, is now damaging and killing the Great Barrier Reef, one of Australia's major tourist attractions, not to mention its biological value in its own right and as a nursery of fish. The term man-made drought refers to a form of land degradation secondary to land clearance, sheep overgrazing, and rabbits. When the cover of vegetation is removed by any of these means, land that the vegetation had previously shaded now becomes directly exposed to the sun, thereby making the soil hotter and drier. Hot and dry soil conditions impede plant growth in much the same way as does a natural drought. Weeds are defined as plants of low value to farmers, either because they are less palatable or totally unpalatable to sheep and cattle, or because they compete with useful crops. Some weeds are plant species introduced from overseas. Others are Australian native plants. Because grazing animals prefer to eat certain plants, the action of grazing animals tends to increase the abundance of weeds and to convert pasture cover to plant species that are less utilized or unutilizable. Weeds vary in the ease with which they can be combated. Some weed species are easy to remove, but other weed species are very expensive or prohibitively difficult to eliminate once they have become established. About 3,000 plant species are considered weeds in Australia today and cause economic losses of about $2 billion per year. To the misguided government policies of land clearance and sheep overstocking may be added the policies of the government's wheat board. It has tended to make rosy predictions of higher world wheat prices, thereby encouraging farmers to incur debt for capital investments and machinery, to plant wheat on land marginal for wheat growing. Many farmers then discovered, to their misfortune, that the land could support wheat for only a few years, and that wheat prices dropped. The remaining cause of land degradation in Australia, salinization, is the most complex and requires the most explanation. I mentioned previously that large areas of Australia contain much salt in the soil, as legacies of salty sea breezes, former ocean basins, or dried-out lakes. While a few plants can tolerate salty soils, most plants, including almost all of our crops, cannot. If the salt below the root zone just stayed there, it wouldn't be a problem. But two processes can bring it up towards the surface and start causing problems: irrigation salinization and dryland salinization. Irrigation salinization has the potential for arising in dry areas where irrigation is necessary, as in parts of southeastern Australia. If a farmer drip irrigates, that is, installs a small irrigation water fixture at the base of each fruit tree or crop row, and allows just enough water to drip out as the trees or crops' roots can absorb, then little water is wasted, and there is no problem. But if the farmer instead follows the commoner practice of broadcast irrigation, that is, flooding the land or else using a sprinkler to distribute the water over a large area, then the ground gets saturated with more water than the roots can absorb. The unabsorbed excess water percolates down to that deeper layer of salty soil, thereby establishing a continuous column of wetted soil through which the deep-lying salt can percolate, either up to the shallow root zone and the surface where it will inhibit or prevent growth of plants, or else down to the groundwater table and from there into a river. In principle, problems of irrigation salinization can be partly mitigated by going to the expense of installing drip irrigation instead of broadcast irrigation. The other process responsible for salinization is dryland salinization, potentially operating in areas where rainfall suffices for agriculture. As long as ground in such areas is still covered with its natural vegetation, the plant's roots take up most of the rain falling. But suppose a farmer clears the natural vegetation and replaces it with crops which are planted seasonally and then harvested, leaving the ground bare for part of the year. Rain soaking the ground when it is bare percolates down to the deep-lying salt, permitting it to diffuse up to the surface. Unlike irrigation salinization, dryland salinization is difficult, expensive, or essentially impossible to reverse once the natural vegetation has been cleared. One can think of salt mobilized by either irrigation or dryland salinization as like a salty underground river, which in some parts of Australia has salt concentrations 3 times those of the ocean. That underground river flows downhill, just as does an above-ground river, but much more slowly. Eventually, it may seep out into a downhill depression, creating hypersaline ponds that I saw in South Australia. If a farmer on a hilltop causes his land to become salinized, the salt may slowly flow through the ground to the land of farms lying downhill, even if those farms are well managed. Some of the underground river doesn't emerge in downhill depressions, but instead flows down into above-ground rivers, including Australia's largest river system, the Murray-Darling. Salinization inflicts heavy financial losses on the Australian economy in 3 ways. First, it is rendering much farmland, including some of the most valuable land in Australia, less productive or useless. Second, some of the salt is carried into city drinking water supplies. For instance, the Murray-Darling River provides between 40% and 90% of the drinking water of Adelaide, but the river's rising salt levels could eventually make it unsuitable for human consumption or crop irrigation without the added expense of desalination. Even more expensive than either of those two problems are the damages caused by salt corroding infrastructure, including roads, railroads, airfields, bridges, buildings, water pipes, sewers, household and industrial appliances, power and telecommunication lines, and water treatment plants. Overall, it is estimated that only about a third of Australia's economic losses arising from salinization are the direct cost to Australian agriculture. The losses to Australia's water supplies and infrastructure cost twice as much. As for the extent of salinization, it already affects about 9% of all cleared land in Australia, and that percentage is projected under present trends to rise to about 25%. Salinization is currently especially serious in the states of Western Australia and South Australia. The former state's wheat belt is considered one of the worst examples of dryland salinization in the world. The proportion of the wheat belt sterilized by salinization is expected to reach 1/3 within the next 2 decades. Underground rivers flow very slowly, such that once one has mobilized salt through bad land management, it may take 500 years to flush that mobilized salt out of the ground, even if one switches overnight to drip irrigation and stops mobilizing further salt. While land degradation resulting from all those causes is Australia's most expensive environmental problem, other sets of serious problems deserve briefer mention, those involving forestry, marine fisheries, and freshwater itself. Apart from Antarctica, Australia is the continent with proportionately the least area covered by forests, only about 20% of the continent's total area. Of Australia's forests standing at the time of European settlement in 1788, 40% have already been cleared. 35% have been partly logged, and only 25% remain intact. Nevertheless, logging of that small area of remaining old-growth forests is continuing and constitutes yet another instance of mining the Australian landscape. The export uses, in addition to domestic consumption, to which timber logged from Australia's remnant forest is being put, are remarkable. Of forest product exports, half are not in the form of logs or finished materials, but are turned into wood chips and sent mostly to Japan, where they are used to produce paper and its products and make up one quarter of the material in Japanese paper. While the price that Japan pays to Australia for those wood chips has dropped to $7 per ton, the resulting paper sells in Japan for $1,000 per ton. At the same time as it exports wood chips, Australia imports nearly three times more forest products than it exports, with more than half of those imports being in the form of paper and paperboard products. One expects to encounter that particular type of asymmetry not in the trade relations between two first-world countries, but instead when an economically backwards, non-industrialized third-world colony, unsophisticated in negotiations, deals with a first-world country sophisticated at exploiting third-world countries. That is, it would appear that Australia is squandering a valuable resource and receiving little money for it. The continued logging of old-growth forests is giving rise to one of the most passionate environmental debates in Australia today. Most of the logging and the fiercest debate are going on in the state of Tasmania, where Tasmania bluegums, at up to 305 feet tall, some of the world's tallest remaining trees outside of California, are now being logged faster than ever. Both of Australia's major political parties favor continued logging. A possible reason is suggested by the fact that, after the National Party announced its strong support for Tasmanian logging in 1995, it became known that the party's three biggest financial contributors were logging companies. The mining of Australia's marine fisheries resembles that of its forests. Australia's marine populations tend to have low growth rates, so that they are easily overfished. Australia has exhibited a history of marine overfishing, mining one stock until it is depleted to uneconomically low levels, then discovering a new fishery and switching to it until it too collapses within a short time, like a gold rush. After a new fishery opens, a scientific study by marine biologists may be initiated to determine the maximal sustainable harvesting rates, but the fishery is at risk of collapsing before recommendations from the study become available. The only Australian marine fishery for which there are well-supported claims of sustainable harvesting involves the Western Australian rock lobster population, which is currently Australia's most valuable seafood export. As for freshwater, Australia is the continent with the least of it. Most of that little freshwater that is readily accessible to populated areas is already utilized for drinking or agriculture. Even the country's largest river, the Murray Darling, has two-thirds of its total water flow drawn off by humans in an average year, and in some years, virtually all of its water. Australia's freshwater sources that remain unutilized consist mainly of rivers in remote northern areas, far from human settlements or agricultural lands where they could be put to use. As Australia's population grows, and as its unutilized supplies of freshwater dwindle, some settled areas may be forced to turn to more expensive desalinization for their fresh water. There is already a desalinization plant on Kangaroo Island, and one may be needed soon on the Eyre Peninsula. In addition to those problems of water quantity, accessibility, and use, there are also issues of water quality. Utilized rivers contain toxins, pesticides, or salts from upstream that reach urban drinking areas and agricultural irrigation areas downstream. Examples that I already mentioned are the salt and agricultural chemicals from the Murray River that furnishes much of Adelaide's drinking water, and the pesticides from New South Wales and Queensland cotton fields that jeopardize the marketability of downstream attempts to grow chemical-free wheat and beef. Thus, Australia has an exceptionally fragile environment, damaged in a multitude of ways, incurring enormous economic costs. Some of those costs stem from past damage that is now irreversible, such as some forms of land degradation and the extinctions of native species, relatively more species in recent times in Australia than on any other continent. Most of the types of damage are still ongoing today, or even increasing or accelerating, as in the case of old-growth forest logging in Tasmania. Many Australian cultural attitudes, as well as government policies, remain the ones that caused damage in the past and are still continuing to cause it. To those of us inclined to pessimism, or even just a realistic sober thinking, all those facts give us reason to wonder whether Australians are doomed to a declining standard of living in a steadily deteriorating environment. That is an entirely realistic scenario for Australia's future, much more likely either than a plunge into an Easter Island-like population crash and political collapse, or than a continuation of current consumption rates and population growth. The realistic prospects of the first scenario apply to the rest of the first world as well, with the sole difference that Australia could end up in the first scenario sooner. Fortunately, there are signs of hope. They involve changing attitudes, private initiatives, and the beginnings of radical governmental initiatives. When I first visited Australia 40 years ago, many Australian landowners responded to criticism that they were damaging their land by responding, "It's my land and I can bloody well do with it whatever I bloody please." While one still hears such attitudes today, they are becoming less frequent and less publicly acceptable. Whereas the government until a few decades ago faced little resistance to its enforcing environmentally destructive regulations and putting through environmentally destructive schemes, the Australian public today is increasingly vocal on environmental matters. Public opposition has been especially loud to land clearance, river development, and old-growth logging. Those public attitudes have just resulted in the South Australian state government instituting a new tax to raise $300 million to undo damage to the Murray River. The Western Australian state government proceeding with the phasing out of old-growth logging. The New South Wales state government and its farmers reaching agreement on a $406 million plan to streamline resource management and end large-scale land clearing, and the state government in Queensland announcing a joint proposal with the national government to end large-scale clearing of mature bushland by the year 2006. All of these measures were unimaginable 40 years ago. Among Australia's many innovative private initiatives to address environmental problems are several that I encountered while visiting a former sheep and farm property of nearly 1,000 square miles near the Murray River, called Calprum Station. First leased for grazing in 1851, it fell victim to the usual panoply of Australian environmental problems: deforestation, foxes, land clearance, over-irrigation, overstocking, rabbits, salinization, weeds, wind erosion, and so on. In 1993, it was bought by the Australian Commonwealth Government and the Chicago Zoological Society, the latter attracted by Australia's pioneering efforts in developing ecologically sustainable land practices. For some years after that purchase, government managers applied top-down control and gave orders to local community volunteers, who became increasingly frustrated until in 1998, control was turned over to the private Australian Landscape Trust, mobilizing 400 local volunteers for bottom-up community management. Under the Trust's management, local volunteers at Calprum threw themselves into whatever projects appealed to each volunteer's own interest. Among the projects that I saw, one volunteer was devoting herself to a small endangered kangaroo species whose population she was trying to restore. Another volunteer preferred to poison foxes, and still other volunteers were attacking the ubiquitous problem of rabbits, seeking ways to control introduced carp in the Murray River, perfecting a strategy for non-chemical control of insect pests of citrus trees, restoring lakes that had become sterile, revegetating overgrazed land, and developing markets for growing and selling local wildflowers and plants controlling erosion. Literally tens of thousands of other such private initiatives are operating around Australia. Complementing these private initiatives are government initiatives that include a radical rethinking of Australian agriculture in response to growing awareness of the seriousness of Australia's problems. The proposals are not coming from idealistic bird-loving environmentalists, but from hard-nosed economists who are asking themselves, would Australia be better off economically without much of its present agricultural enterprise? The background to this rethinking is the realization that only tiny areas of Australian land currently being used for agriculture are suitable for sustained agricultural operations. While 60% of Australia's land area and 80% of its human water use are dedicated to agriculture, agriculture now contributes less than 3% of the gross national product. That's a huge allocation of land and scarce water to an enterprise of such low value. About 80% of Australia's agricultural profits are derived from less than 0.8% of its agricultural land. Most of Australia's remaining agriculture is, in effect, a mining operation that merely converts environmental capital of soil and native vegetation irreversibly into cash, with the help of indirect government subsidies in the forms of below-cost water, tax concessions, and free telephone link-ups and other infrastructure. Is it a good use of Australian taxpayers' money to subsidize so much unprofitable and destructive land use? Even from the narrowest point of view, some Australian agriculture is uneconomic to the individual consumer, who can buy products more cheaply as imports from overseas than as domestic produce. Much agriculture is also uneconomic to the individual farmer, as measured by what is termed profit at full equity. That is, if one counts among a farm's expenses not only its cash expenditures, but also the value of the farmer's labor, two-thirds of Australia's agricultural land operates at a net loss to the farmer. That's the economic value of much Australian farming to the consumer and the farmer. What about its value to Australia as a whole? For any given piece of the farming enterprise, one has to take into account a broadened view of its costs to the entire economy, as well as its benefits. One big piece of those broadened costs is government support to farmers through means such as tax subsidies and expenditures for drought assistance, research, advising, and agricultural extension services. Those government expenditures eat up about one-third of Australian agriculture's nominal net profits. Another big piece of those broadened costs is the losses that agriculture imposes on other segments of the Australian economy. In effect, agricultural uses of land compete with other potential uses of the same land, and using one piece of land for agriculture may damage the value of another piece of land for tourism, forestry, fisheries, recreation, or even for agriculture itself. An example considers Australia's agricultural production of the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane. The carbon dioxide emissions from Australian agriculture exceed those produced by motor vehicles and all the rest of the transport industry. Even worse are cows, whose digestion produces methane, 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide in causing global warming. The simplest way for Australia to fulfill its stated commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions would be to eliminate its cattle. While that and other radical suggestions have been put forward, there are currently no signs of their being adopted soon. It would be a first for the modern world if a government voluntarily decided to phase out much of its agricultural enterprise in anticipation of future problems before being forced in desperation to do so. Nevertheless, even the mere existence of these suggestions raises a larger point. Australia illustrates in extreme form the exponentially accelerating horse race in which the world now finds itself. On the one hand, the development of environmental problems in Australia, as in the whole world, is accelerating exponentially. On the other hand, the development of public environmental concern and of private and governmental countermeasures is also accelerating exponentially. Which horse will win the race? Many listeners of this book are young enough and will live long enough to see the outcome. Education is a process involving two sets of participants who supposedly play different roles: teachers who impart knowledge to students, and students who absorb knowledge from teachers. In fact, as every open-minded teacher discovers, education is also about students imparting knowledge to their teachers by challenging the teacher's assumptions and by asking questions that the teachers hadn't previously thought of. I recently repeated that discovery when I taught a course on how societies cope with environmental problems to highly motivated undergraduates at the University of California at Los Angeles. My first lecture was on the collapse of Easter Island society. In the class discussion after I had finished my presentation, the apparently simple question that most puzzled my students was one whose actual complexity hadn't sunk into me before. How on earth could a society make such an obviously disastrous decision as to cut down all the trees on which it depended? One of the students asked what I thought the islander who cut down the last palm tree said as he was doing it. They also asked the related question, how often did people wreck ecological damage intentionally, or at least while aware of the likely consequences? How often did people instead do it without meaning to, or out of ignorance? My students wondered whether, if there are still people left alive 100 years from now, those people of the next century will be as astonished about our blindness today as we are about the blindness of the Easter Islanders. My UCLA undergraduates have identified a baffling phenomenon, namely failures of group decision-making on the part of whole societies or other groups. Individuals, too, make bad decisions. They enter bad marriages, they make bad investments and career choices, their businesses fail, and so on. But some additional factors enter into failures of group decision-making, such as conflicts of interest among members of the group and group dynamics. This is obviously a complex subject to which there would not be a single answer fitting all situations. What I'm going to propose instead is a roadmap of factors contributing to failures of group decision-making. I'll divide the factors into a fuzzily delineated sequence of 4 categories. The first stop on my roadmap is that groups may do disastrous things because they failed to anticipate a problem before it arrived, for any of several reasons. One is that they may have had no prior experience of such problems. A prime example is the mess that British colonists created for themselves when they introduced foxes and rabbits from Britain into Australia in the 1800s. Even prior experience is not a guarantee that a society will anticipate a problem if the experience happened so long ago to have been forgotten. For instance, Chaco Canyon Anasazi Society survived several droughts before succumbing to a big drought in the 12th century AD. But the earlier droughts had occurred long before the birth of any Anasazi affected by the big drought, which would thus have been unanticipated because the Anasazi lacked writing. In modern literate societies, we don't necessarily draw on prior experience committed to writing. We, too, tend to forget things. For a year or two after the gas shortages of the 1973 Gulf oil crisis, we Americans shied away from gas-guzzling cars. But then we forgot that experience and are now embracing SUVs. When the city of Tucson in Arizona went through a severe drought in the 1950s, its alarmed citizens swore that they would manage their water better, but soon returned to their water-guzzling ways of building golf courses and watering their gardens. Another reason why a society may fail to anticipate a problem involves reasoning by false analogy. For instance, when Viking colonists encountered in Iceland many of the same tree species already familiar to them from Norway and Britain, they were deceived by the apparent similarity of the landscape. Unfortunately, Iceland's soils arose not through glacial grinding, but through winds carrying light ash blown out in volcanic eruptions. Once the Vikings had cleared Iceland's forest to create pastures for their livestock, the light soil became exposed, and much of Iceland's topsoil soon eroded away. The second stop on my roadmap involves a society failing to perceive a problem that has actually arrived. There are at least 3 reasons for such failures. First, the origins of some problems are literally imperceptible. For example, the nutrients responsible for soil fertility are invisible to the eye. There was no way for the first colonists of Australia to perceive the problem of soil nutrient exhaustion. Another frequent reason for failure to perceive a problem is distant managers, a potential issue in any large society or business. For example, the largest private landowner and timber company in Montana today is based 400 miles away in Seattle, Washington. Not being on the scene, company executives may not realize that they have a big weed problem on their forest properties. Perhaps the commonest circumstance under which societies fail to perceive a problem is when it takes the form of a slow trend concealed by wide up-and-down fluctuations. The prime example in modern times is global warming. Climate fluctuates up and down erratically from year to year. 3 degrees warmer in one summer than in the previous one. Then 2 degrees warmer the next summer. Down 4 degrees the following summer. Down another degree the next one. Then up 5 degrees, etc. With such large and unpredictable fluctuations, it has taken a long time to discern the average upwards trend of 0.01 degrees per year within that noisy signal. Politicians use the term creeping normalcy to refer to such slow trends concealed within noisy fluctuations. If anything is deteriorating only slowly, it's difficult to recognize that each successive year is on the average slightly worse than the year before. So one's baseline standard for what constitutes normalcy shifts gradually and imperceptibly. Another term related to creeping normalcy is landscape amnesia, forgetting how different the surrounding landscape looked 50 years ago, because the change from year to year has been so gradual. I suspect that landscape amnesia provided part of the answer to my UCLA student's question, what did the Easter Islander who cut down the last palm tree say as he was doing it? We unconsciously imagine a sudden change. One year, the island still covered with a forest of tall palm trees. The next year, just a single tree left, which an islander proceeds to fell in an act of incredibly self-damaging stupidity. Much more likely, though, the changes in forest cover from year to year would have been almost undetectable. Yes, this year we cut down a few trees over there, but saplings are starting to grow back again here. Gradually, Easter Island's trees became fewer, smaller, and less important. At the time that the last fruit-bearing adult palm tree was cut, the species had long ago ceased to be of any economic significance. That left only smaller and smaller palm saplings to clear each year, along with other bushes and treelets. No one would have noticed the falling of the last little palm sapling. By then, the memory of the valuable palm forest of centuries earlier had succumbed to landscape amnesia.